Okay, the subject for today is two additional lectures on China studies, and then a closing lecture on the subject of justice in economic development. So again, there's a kind of interesting connection between the lectures. In the first two lectures, I'll be talking about different theories of Chinese economic development, especially in the late, well, the Ming-Qing dynasties. So economic development during the Ming-Qing dynasties. That's the subject of the first two lectures. And then the third lecture is on the subject of globalization and the issues of justice and international stability that seem to be just absolutely center stage in the area of global economic development, globalization. So today, lecture 11, the subject of the lecture is called Eurasian Comparisons, Institutions, Organizations, and Knowledge Systems. But the central idea here is the idea of Eurasian comparison. And so in this lecture, we will be looking at some of the factors that are involved in making comparisons about the economic history of Europe and Asia. And I have found this to be just a tremendously interesting subject. There was a long period of time in which economic history was written from the point of view of Western Europe, written from the point of view of England. And so the idea was that there is such a thing as modern economic development. It occurred in one place, that is England and Western Europe. And the trajectory of that development is the normal and natural way of economic systems to develop over historical time. And if there are choices, there is just the choice between success and failure. Successful economic development, the idea was, successful economic development is development like that of England and Western Europe through the agricultural revolution of the 1600s to the industrial revolution of the 1700s and 1800s to the formation of states and institutions which support industrial development and factory development. That trajectory of economic development, of Western economic development, was taken by many economic historians as being the defining paradigm of economic development. And then people would ask questions like, why did China fail? Why was China not successful in achieving economic breakthrough in the 14th century or in the 15th century? What I'm putting forward today is that this is a bad way of understanding historical economic development. It's a bad way of understanding because it assumes there is just one pathway of economic development, and that is the path of England and Western Europe. Whereas what I will suggest to you during this lecture, economic historians of China have found that Chinese economic development had a different characteristic, a different set of institutions and arrangements, a different set of culture practices, a different set of technologies, and that therefore the economic history of China is just as important from the point of view of understanding processes of economic development. And that furthermore, there are interesting points of both parallel between economic development in Europe and in Asia, and points of contrast. So the point then is that doing Eurasian comparison, doing comparison of Western European development and East Asian development, is important to do. It is also scientifically important and scientifically interesting to do because it gives us a different set of tools for understanding the important kind of institutional changes and processes which are underway in economic and political development. And as a matter of fact, there is very interesting work occurring in the United States, in Great Britain, and in China today on the subject of comparative economic history, making use of really high-quality economic history techniques and scientific methods for the study of the development of China. And then those two research communities, the Chinese economic historians and the European economic historians, coming together and developing a better understanding of the process as a whole. So there is, in fact, a very interesting debate and an interesting literature which has developed on the subject of economic history across the full scope of Eurasia, or Europe to Asia. The idea that Western historians have traditionally regarded industrial revolution as being the central topic, and then have asked the question, why did China not experience an industrial revolution in the 14th, 15th, or 16th century? That has been the way that economic history has been characterized, but now historians and economic historians are posing their questions differently. They're asking, what are the different types of economic institutions, political institutions, property institutions, which existed in the different parts of the Eurasian continent, which gave rise to different characteristics of economic development. And a point that I feel it is very important to emphasize, and I feel that it is a point that is strongly supported by the comparative economic history which is now occurring, the point is there are alternative pathways of economic development. There are alternative sets of institutions which are equally feasible, but which lead to a very different pathway of economic development. And we see that actually even within Europe or within Asia. The contrast between China and India in the 16th century, for example, that's an important contrast. But within China, the lower Yangtze had a different characteristic of development than other parts of China. So that examining economic history in detail tells us that there are valid and effective alternatives in the design of social and economic institutions. And therefore, we have much to learn by, we being all economic historians, have much to learn by studying carefully the institutional arrangements which were in place in the 16th century, in the Ming Dynasty, in the 17th century, into the Qing Dynasty. What were those basic economic institutions, those basic institutions of population and government and taxation, what were those basic institutions through which agricultural development occurred, manufacturing development occurred, and eventually industrial development occurred. So the challenge of economic history, and especially of comparative economic history, is to notice, in a sense, I'm now taking a philosopher's step back. I'm stepping back from the concrete specifics of these debates, and I'm asking you, and I'm asking myself the question, what is economic history? What is it about? What is the subject matter of economic history? And this paragraph basically is intended to describe the general content of economic history. In economic history of Europe or Asia or other places, we can observe a number of important processes. Things like changes in the level of productivity and the level of output in agriculture. And so economic historians can basically acquire the data that permits us to provide a graph of crop output per hectare in England from 1600 to 1700 to 1800, and in the lower Yangtze from in the same period of time. So we can look at changes in productivity and output. We can look at changes in productivity and output in manufacturing. We can look at population change. In other words, what I'm kind of trying to get your thought process going on here is we're looking at a multivariable, big social process involving population, involving agriculture, involving state, involving taxation, involving surplus and land rent. In other words, involving lots of institutions and technologies and people performing ordinary activities, resulting in agricultural output, level of population welfare, because if agricultural output is high relative to population, then the standard of living is high. If food output is low relative to population, then the standard of living is low. There's hunger, there's malnutrition, there's low income. But also, I've just now picked out change of productivity in agriculture and manufacture, population change, but we can also talk about urbanization. We can talk about what is the pattern in 1600, in 1650, in 1700, in England, in France, in China, the balance between rural people and urban people, and the process of urbanization and the creation of towns and eventually great cities. We can talk also about technology change. Throughout this process of productivity, change, urbanization, we also see substantial history of technology change in the different settings. We see technology change in agriculture in China. We see technology change in power manufacture, water power, eventually steam power. In other words, technology change is another aspect of this picture. Social differentiation occurs as well. Some of you, in writing your paper on the subject of class theory, put forward the view that classes, the theory of class is only relevant in a fairly differentiated society, that a society that is very flat, meaning everyone is about the same, that the concept of class is not useful there. Social differentiation, the creation of different categories of people, peasant people, merchant people, owners of land, government officials, these processes are a part of the process of economic development which we're interested in tracking. Patterns of the standard of living. This is a tremendously important question. We could put the question this way. What was the standard of living in the year 1200 for an English farmer person? What was the standard of living? And what was the standard of living for a farmer person in the lower Yangtze in 1200? We can ask that question. And economic historians then attempt through direct and indirect research to come up with an estimate of the standard of living. And you could now, this is a great occasion for you to think analytically, you could ask yourself, well, what's involved in the standard of living? What is the standard of living? And you might say, well, first of all, it's food. So the amount and quality and variety of food which is available to a typical farmer person or a typical worker person or a typical merchant person, we would like to be able to estimate the total calorie content, the total food value content of the diet. What about housing? What about clothing? What about transportation? In other words, to estimate the quality of life, or the standard of living, we need to operationalize. We need to identify the elements which we would like to measure for the farmer person of England in 1200, etc. And then we need to collect the relevant data. And economic historians have spent an awful lot of time and an awful lot of energy and with a lot of success in trying to measure the standard of living in England in 1500 or in 1600. And there is the theory that, let's say, 1400, 1500, 1600, 1700, and 1800, and we're now, what I'm going to graph here is standard of living for a farmer. And there was an assumption that English farmers over this period of time, if anything, dropped a bit and then began very gradually rising, standard of living, quality of life, level of income. meaning those things like the total food content of their diet and so forth. And it has been assumed that Chinese farmers were substantially lower, that Chinese farmers were at the edge of starvation, and so it might have been like this, very stagnant, low standard of living and lower than English farmer standard of living. The most recent efforts to estimate the standard of living of English and Chinese farmers actually shows a very different characteristic. What it shows is that, and this is work, by the way, that is done, among others, by Li Bozhang, Bozhang Li, the historian at Tsinghua University, economic historian at Tsinghua University. Bozhang Li is one of the people who has established that Chinese farmer standard of living throughout this period was sometimes higher than English standard of living, sometimes drifting down, but overall constant and moderate, not deeply impoverished and not getting worse, but rather constant and moderate over a very long period of time. So this is Yangtze peasant, and this is English peasant. Now you notice that the English peasant standard of living begins to rise around 1600. In other words, there is a substantial change in agricultural productivity around 1600. You've now read, I hope you've read, the Elvin essay and the Brenner essay in my book. They're both on this subject of agricultural revolution around 1600. Well, the point then is, if we dig into the economic history data and we try to determine what was the level of agricultural productivity, what was the standard of living, we find surprising things. The assumption which Western economic historians have often made, Chinese peasants were at the subsistence level and getting worse, that turns out not to be correct. There are very substantial differences in the form of technology, in the land-man-technology ratios, big differences in agriculture in England and China. But in terms of overall standard of living, poor people in the two countries were at about the same level. That's the idea. That's totally interesting. It's a very interesting finding, and it's also interesting to, you know, if you're a kind of philosophically minded observer of economic history, it is very interesting to observe the ways in which data are used in order to estimate things like the standard of living. The one other big type of change which needs to be attended to as we think about what is economic history, we need to look at the governmental and state context of economic activity. And again, here too, we find a changing mix of state institutions, a changing mix of the power of the state, the fiscal ability of the state, the ability of the state to promulgate new ideas and new technologies. All of these features of the state are also worth, they're a part of the story and part of the causal explanation that we would like to be able to give. So the challenge then is to try to, number one, in a sense, come up with a whole series of graphs of things like agricultural productivity, output per hectare, output per unit of labor time, quality of life. In other words, we would like to have something like graphs, time series graphs, time series graphs of economic variables over time. That's the data of economic history. We would then like to have an account of the causes and effects of these processes of change. We would like to be able to say, for China, for example, what is it which permitted the Chinese population to remain about level in terms of standard of living at a time when the population was increasing radically? You might think rapid population increase in a fixed land area should lead to falling standards of living. That would be a very natural conclusion to arrive at, and yet what we find is a relatively constant standard of living. Well, what explains that? That is the explanatory subject of comparative economic history. What can we learn about the causal and institutional characteristics of the various historical settings of economic and political development? And the concept which I have, and I believe the concept which is coming out of this literature in the US and in China, is that institutions are central to the description of outcomes, that we need to have a good understanding of the institutions which govern economic activity, whether it's the social property system, that's what Robert Brenner emphasizes, or it is the particular characteristics of the state in the context of which economic activity takes place. We can notice there are differences in the basic institutions, and the basic institutions make a difference for the economic outcomes. So this then suggests that comparative economic history has three areas of questioning. And again, you could take this as an example of me as a philosopher now of history, a philosopher of history, trying to analyze what is the form of knowledge which is offered by economic history. And I'm suggesting there are three or four components of historical knowledge in this area. First, descriptive, factual research into productivity, technique, standard of living, handicraft output, prices. There are historians who've spent their entire careers reconstructing price series for grain over a 200-year period in Yangtze Delta and in England. So there is descriptive work, descriptive factual work. Secondly, there is investigation of the economic, political, and social institutions embodied in the two societies, in English society, in Chinese society, or in European society, in Asian society. So investigation of the concrete economic, political, and social institutions. Third, there is formulation of causal hypotheses about the patterns and the differences of outcome. Just to take one small example, population increase, land productivity and agriculture, and average standard of living. Think of those three variables, population increase, land productivity, and average standard of living. And now ask yourself the question, how can it be with a rising population, fixed land, that nonetheless the standard of living remains relatively constant? This graph implies the answer, or it implies what must be the answer, namely that there was rising productivity in agriculture. Over that period of time, if instead of graphing the standard of living, we were graphing output of rice per hectare, per mu, if we were graphing output, we would find that output per mu was rising during this period of time. But we would also find that it was rising at about the same rate of increase as population. So if you were to say, land productivity rice per mu is mu in English, I think. Anyway, land productivity, rice per mu, and population increase, if these two percent, let's say that it's 2%, if land productivity is rising at 2% per year, that means every year 2% more rice being cultivated and cropped in the same land area. So increase in the total amount of rice. If population increase is also 2%, then the net increase is zero. The net increase per capita, or in other words, it's something like this graph here. On the other hand, if land productivity is rising, faster. If it's 3% land productivity increase and 2% population increase, that would imply that the standard of living will begin to rise, because there's more rice per unit of land and also per unit of population. That's an interesting result. We can roll that forward one more step, and we can say, is it inevitable that with productivity rising at 3%, population rising at 2%, the standard of living rises? It is not inevitable, because we remember Marxism. We remember that Marxism highlights surplus extraction. This is an important point. This is like a discovery of relevance. We remember Marxism, and we might say that additional 1%, let's say that it was 3% increase in land productivity, 2% increase in population, and 1% goes to landlord is what I wrote here. I'll fall right off the edge here. In other words, surplus extraction is another possibility. Agriculture gets more productive, but the landowning class is able to capture the benefits of additional productivity. In that case, the standard of living for the landlord class goes up, but the standard of living for the peasant stays constant. That's another possibility. What would determine that outcome? The institutional arrangements in agriculture determine the outcome. If the landlord class is powerful, if they are able to capture the benefits of productivity increase, then they get the surplus. If the peasantry is powerful, if they can demand to keep that additional output, then their standard of living goes up. So it's a great small example of class struggle. Isn't that an interesting example? It's struggle over the benefits of rising productivity in land. One additional point to be made here. This is not a bad empirical description of what was occurring in China between 1400 and 1800. It is a reasonably accurate description. But we can ask one other question. One other question. What about labor productivity? Which would be rice per day of labor. In other words, to produce a catty of rice requires, let's say, 10 days of labor. Dad's labor, the children's labor, and a little bit of hired labor. On average, let us say it takes 10 days of labor to produce that quantity of rice. So one catty per 10 days. Here's a way of increasing land productivity. Double cropping is a way, putting more labor into the cultivation process is a way of increasing productivity of agriculture. More intensive farming is a way of increasing productivity. But more intensive farming means a decline in labor productivity. That in order to get that additional amount of rice, it's necessary now to put in 15, or let's not be radical, 13 days of labor per catty. This is a way of increasing the amount of rice produced, but at the cost of expending even more human labor. To the extent that this process, the intensification of cultivation effort, is the explanation for why land productivity rose in China. To that extent, you might say family labor time is being more and more inefficiently used. It's being used more and more prodigiously. In other words, now we've got this. These are totally interesting. You could get totally involved. You could all become economic historians if you wanted to. It would be that interesting, because you could now be examining what happened in Chinese agriculture, in average landholding size, in output of grain per mu, in output of grain per day of labor, you could see that these graphs are moving in different directions. And then finally, you could calculate what is the average standard of living in the lower Yangtze, which is the graph that we have here. And you could then ask, what then were the explanations of each of those processes? Why did labor become more intensive? Why was land so limited? Stuff like that. Okay. So I'm now back to the idea. Are you able to see this? Actually, it looks kind of dim. Should we close the, maybe we should close the curtain there. You probably haven't seen a thing, actually. Oh, that's way better. That's way better. Okay, so we're then interested. I'm trying to give a flavor for what economic history analysis involves and why it's an exciting task, but also why comparative economic history is especially interesting. Because each of these trends, we do the graphs for Yangtze and we do the graphs for England, there will be important differences in the trends. Use of draft animals, like horses and oxen, for example. The involvement of oxen and horses in English agriculture was maybe 7 to 10 times higher than the corresponding statistic in Chinese agriculture. That's an interesting fact. Chinese agriculture was much more labor intensive. English agriculture was much more land expensive. Okay. So new research, what's occurring then in these debates, and I did want to refer to the names of several of these researchers. R. Bin Wang is an American historian who wrote a very, very fine book called, I forget what it's called, but it's a very good book of comparative Eurasian economic history. And he is one of the pathbreakers who is saying, to do comparison, you must do real comparison. You must look in detail. You must not privilege the one story or the other, but instead look at the real differences and similarities. So that's Bin Wang. Ken Pomerantz is another prominent American historian who's written on the same subject. James Lee, I've mentioned his name before because he is professor at the University of Michigan, but also the director of the program here in China. So he is frequently at PKU. He's a familiar face at PKU. Bozong Li is the professor at Tsinghua University, with whom I'm having supper tonight. Philip Huang, several of you have mentioned that you know who Philip Huang is. And then an English historian named Robert Allen, who has estimated in really exquisite detail the nature of agriculture in England. He has done, now how would you do that? He has done through really detailed analysis of things like farm book records from 1400, very, very old farm book records. He has been able to estimate things like the total amount of labor that is involved in the production of corn, the total number of horses or horse days that are used in the production of corn, the total corn production per hectare, etc. So Robert Allen is one of those descriptive economic historians who has given us a really good, reasonably precise understanding of these basic variables. And I would say that these approaches show really important new light on general questions about the social and institutional characteristics of economic development. And as a matter of fact, once we dig into these topics, once we look at English agriculture and Chinese agriculture, even the parts of the story that we thought we well understood in the past, like what was English agriculture, or for that matter, what was Chinese agriculture, it turns out that the institutional and the empirical situation is more complex than we had initially thought. Maybe a nice example of that is that even within Europe, there were very important differences in the institutional and economic characteristics of agriculture in France and England. So French agriculture, English agriculture had a different profile in terms of productivity and eventually in terms of agricultural revolution. That's the subject of the Robert Brenner essay, my essay about Robert Brenner. So in other words, comparative economic history, even within a region, shows important differences, which we can then offer analytical, causal explanation of. And so discovering the parallels and divergences across economic institutions and outcomes allows us to reevaluate claims about causal centrality of some processes while giving new emphasis to other causal processes. The kind of things which economic historians have typically looked at as causes, you might say there are three big causes which have been the main causal theories. First of all, population dynamics. The Malthusian idea. The Malthusian idea that English population dynamics were controlled by economic opportunity. So English population increase was gradual, and Chinese population increase was uncontrolled and tended always to increase to the total carrying capacity of agriculture. So the Malthusian hypothesis, basically, we have two little panels here, says English population increase looks like that, Chinese population increase looks like that, and therefore agricultural revolution could never happen in China because there's never a basis for supporting agricultural development and agricultural innovation. That's a Malthusian theory of population increase. Very important contemporary work being done by James Lee demonstrates that Chinese demographic patterns were very similar to European demographic patterns. They resulted from different institutional arrangements, different family arrangements, for example, but the total net effect was that this contrast is incorrect, that Chinese demographic behavior was much more similar to English population behavior. So population behavior, that's one possible theory or causal value. Secondly, technology change. And let's not talk high technology. Let's not talk electric fans and air conditioners. Let's talk rice varieties or irrigation technologies. The use of simple tools to move water around from river to crop. Those innovations, technology innovations, can have dramatic effect on output. And so you might say what leads to the rising level of land output is a series of technology innovations. But then you can ask yourself the question, what is it that drives technology innovation? And why are some societies highly innovative, lots of technology innovation, and other societies are not? That is now another historical question to be asked. Thirdly, so population is a question. Technology change is a question. A third question is governmental institutions. And some people have said that for whatever reason, English governmental institutions were particularly encouraging of economic transformation and economic development, whereas the claim has historically been made, the Chinese state was a bureaucracy, it was stultifying, it expressed too much power at the center and therefore gave too little opportunity to entrepreneurs and farmers. Those claims have been made. The discovery we have from contemporary economic history is that we have to investigate the claims. We can't simply take them as received. So that's a third factor, state institutions. And a fourth factor would be economic variables like prices. So people sometimes think that when prices for grain begin to rise, prices for rice begin to rise, that gives an incentive to making other kinds of adjustments in agriculture, with the result that there will be new creative effort and a new surge of productivity. So price history is a fourth big sort of question. It is now, I think, abundantly clear that the model of Western development is not a natural or paradigm instance of modernization, of development, or of historical change. we now understand very well the richness of examining Chinese economic history and contrasting it and comparing it with European and English economic history, that our theory of economic development will be more nuanced. It will have more variation and detail as a result of careful study of Chinese economic history. The theories of social, economic, and political change which have emerged from the Western experience are flawed in that they seem to suggest there is one preferred pathway of development. We've been talking about Marxism some in this series, and Marxism is actually guilty of this view. It is guilty of the idea that there is a standard logic of development of the capitalist mode of production, and that's what we should expect. Well, comparative economic history shows us that there are other possible pathways of sustained growth. So we need to come to a better appreciation of the contingency of large historical processes, but also a point that I emphasize quite a bit, emphasize more the plasticity and variability, the deformability, the changeability and variability of social and economic institutions. And finally, the comparative research gives us a good framework for testing hypotheses about the causes of large-scale historical change. So what caused agricultural revolution in modern England? This is a case study, really, but it's the Brenner case, which I describe in my essay. You can go to the original, and Robert Brenner's two articles are just tremendously important. They're really powerful articles, but they're both on the subject of English agricultural revolution. And what Brenner puts forward is what I would call a micro-foundational Marxist theory of economic change. Because what Brenner notices is England had an agricultural revolution in the 1600s. It had a period where productivity was floating along pretty much constant and then began inflecting upward around 1600. So what Brenner notices is agricultural productivity pretty much constant in England through about 1600, and then it starts going up. So output per hectare in England began going up around 1600. In France, that did not occur. So there was agricultural revolution in England, but not in France. And the question, great causal question, is why did England experience an agricultural revolution? Robert Brenner's theory, I think it's a very important theory, his theory is that there was an institutional difference between France and England. It was a post-feudal difference, feudalism, that feudalism in France had created power at the level of the lord, and so there was a monarchy, but then real political power was in the hands of lords throughout the countryside. And then there were towns, villages, and farmers. England also had a post-feudalism experience. Its experience was a more rational experience. There was a more direct kind of hierarchy from lord to peasant. Well, here's what Brenner finds. He finds that in France, when modernizing landlords wanted to introduce innovations in agriculture, peasants had too much power. They were able to resist innovations in agriculture, which they didn't like for reasons that are kind of obvious. It involved taking some of their property away, it involved taking some of their rights away, some of the product of the land away from them. So peasants did not like the innovations associated with modernizing agriculture. And they had, through their villages, they had the ability to resist. I don't mean forcibly through peasant rebellion, but just it takes power to get people to change. Peasant communities in France had enough power to resist the kind of modernizing change which was associated with agricultural revolution. In England, the situation was different from that. In England, Brenner finds that English peasants had very little power, at the peasant level, and their communities also had very little power. The wards and the landlords had a much greater degree of power. Therefore, conclusion, it is possible in England for the reforming landlord to introduce innovations in agriculture, which led to higher productivity, which led also to further disempowerment of peasants, and yet English agriculture then became more productive. So it's a paradoxical story. What it says is French peasants were able to exercise political power, resist modernization, and keep agriculture low productivity, which in the end was not good for them. In the end, French agricultural productivity lagged behind English productivity. So, in other words, Brenner's answer to the question, what caused agricultural revolution in England, is the social property system, the way in which power and land were utilized, who had which incentives, and who was able to prevail. It is Brenner's view that the superior power of the landlord and the lord in England led to agricultural revolution. Why did Chinese agriculture tend to improve productivity at the pace of population growth? What were the variables that pushed enhancement or improvement of Chinese agriculture? Well, here you could say population and price is a good explanation, because as population increases, as the population in a particular area increases, there really is only one or maybe two alternatives. The one alternative is to put more land, more labor into the cultivation of scarce land. And so double cropping, intercropping, the application of more intensive weeding, different ways of using more human labor, that is a very natural and predictable response to rising population in the context of limited land. And I also suggest that this basic question about comparison of standard of living is a very important question. So the big factors that we could turn to explain and analyze differences in economic outcomes historically in England and in China: surplus extraction system, population growth, technology change, state capacity, and the development of scientific knowledge. The paradox, or what is surprising about Chinese economic history, is that China was, by almost all indicators, way advanced beyond Europe in the year 1200. In 1200, Chinese culture, Chinese science, Chinese agriculture, in so many different areas, China was well beyond the capacity of England and Europe in science and technology and in agriculture and manufacturing. So the question is, why did that advantage not persist in a permanent economic advantage? And that is one of the questions which comparative economic history is intended to...
Let's start over there.
There we go. Got a bad technology here. Okay, I think we can wrap this. This is a two-part lecture, so the next one kind of carries on this this set of ideas. Maybe the best way of closing this lecture, though, is to say that once we open up the topic of comparative economic history, we find that there is a big, big set of opportunities for social explanation and for the discovery of social and historical alternatives. We can see with the work of empirical description, which economic historians are doing, and with the theoretical work, which people like James Lee, Bin Wang, and Bozhang Li are doing, that we have a great opportunity for making causal arguments, causal explanations of both the similarities and the differences across cases. And because we have these two very well-developed cases, Chinese agriculture was very sophisticated, English agriculture was very sophisticated, they worked through different institutions, different environmental constraints, and so forth, we can also trace through to what the causal kind of what the causal variables were that actually made a difference. So let's stop at that point. We'll talk for a little bit, we'll break, and then we'll come back to this series of topics in the next lecture. So what do you think? Do you find economic history as fascinating as I do? Is it like way, way too cool? How much do you know as Chinese students about, maybe we turn on the light there, how much do you know about the history of Chinese agriculture, for example? The story that I was telling about the standard of living in the 12th century, in the Ming Dynasty, into the Qing Dynasty, is this a familiar story or is it not? Yeah. You're pointing out an important fact about my presentation, because my presentation did not mention environmental factors like weather and climate, and yet, as you say, these factors are very, very important. You might make the next mistake and say they are the most important, whereas what I would want to assert is that the social institutional context is equally important. But you're absolutely right to make that qualification. How about surplus extraction? We came to this interesting moment during the lecture that if land productivity is rising more rapidly than population, in theory, that could lead to a rising standard of living. But if the property relations are such that one class can capture the difference, then you don't have a rising standard of living. Well, isn't that an interesting point? I find it an interesting point. Because it says something about, in a way, about the concrete importance of one piece of Marxism, the piece that emphasizes social surplus extraction and the power of different classes to capture. If what you have in general in a certain region is just peasant farmers, they're the only ones who are on the scene at all, then rising productivity means a rising standard of living for peasants. But if you have peasant farmers and landlords, and if the landlords have substantial social power, then rising productivity may simply mean more wealth for the landlords. That's kind of the bottom line. And that, I think, that's just a sober piece of social analysis. It lines up very well with Marxism, but it's not ideology. It's a feature of institutions and is, I think, just a good piece of social analysis. But again, it probably resonates a little bit with you in terms of Chinese thinking about landlords and peasants and farmers and rents and so forth.
Mm-hmm.